From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. You're young, educated, got an entrepreneurial spirit. So what's keeping you tied to where you live? Is it your job? Well, small cities and towns are asking those very same questions, and they want you. They need you. They have plenty to offer: culture, great food, affordable living. But they just don't have the kinds of jobs to get you to move there. So some places are starting to get creative. They're offering cash and other perks to lure you to their vicinities. But there's a catch. You need to have a job where you can work remotely. It's an inventive way to draw young workers without the race-to-the-bottom tax breaks usually offered to major companies. But does it work? Can it draw and keep new residents in cities and states? And this hour on Point, it's part two of our special series, Where We Call Home. Move here, but work there. And you can join us. Could you work remotely and live anywhere? What would it take to get you to pack up your laptop and move your life to a different place? Would $10,000 in cash do the trick? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, let's start in Tulsa, Oklahoma today. Tulsa has a novel program. It's called Tulsa Remote. And if you log on to the website, you'll see this message in big, bold type. Quote, "Hi, remote workers. We'll pay you to work from Tulsa. You're going to love it here." Well, that love includes a $10,000 stipend and other perks if you commit to living in Tulsa for 1 year. More than 10,000 people applied for Tulsa Remote. About 100 of them made the cut, including Elizabeth Saunders. She joins us now from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Elizabeth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi. So you work at the University of California, Berkeley. We'll talk more about your job in just a second. But what made you want to apply to be one of the fellowship winners for the Tulsa Remote Program?
Yeah, I think when you work remotely, everywhere is kind of an option. And how do you pick is pretty tough. And someone who I respect who works in the gig economy field had shared the Tulsa Remote posting on LinkedIn, and I went, well, there's a good reason to pick somewhere. Is I've heard great things about Tulsa, and from different programs that I've seen, they were actively trying to incorporate the participants in the community and not just saying, hey, here's money, here's a place to work, see you later. So that was one of the big draws for me, and again, I've heard great things about Tulsa.
So you're there now. I mean, had you been there before?
I drove through once on a road trip.
You drove through once. Okay. And so what are your first impressions of Tulsa, Oklahoma?
I absolutely love it. It's everything I like to see with kind of investment and revitalization of an area. They're keeping the character and the culture while still bringing some modernization and new life to the area. And I think that's great because oftentimes you see people just tear down and build new, and I think that's a shame.
So the Tulsa Remote Program is offering the fellows like you who got chosen for the program $10,000 apportioned out over the course of a full year, right? Also some housing assistance if you want to live in one of the buildings there in Tulsa, a co-working space, if I understand this correctly. Are you taking them up on all of their offers?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm very excited to the co-working space looks amazing, and they are offering a ton of support in the local community, as well as, I mean, it's one of the few places that you can get a loft apartment downtown and actually be able to afford and enjoy the nightlife and everything that the city has to offer. Without maybe being a top-notch lawyer or a doctor, which when I was living in San Francisco, that was the case.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about your job. I have your title here as Program Director, Chief of Staff, and Instructor at the Innovation Acceleration Group at the University of California, Berkeley. Now, those that title, to me, it makes it feel like you have the kind of job that actually needs FaceTime with your team. I mean, right? You're Chief of Staff of a program there. How does that work remotely?
Yes. So we're actually a very small team. So we're a working group set deep down inside the university's affiliate organizations. So we're actually a small direct team of two with a larger kind of team around the world, actually, of different instructors who support our projects. And what we do is we teach corporate innovation and entrepreneurship around the world, and we don't do that on campus. So actually, when we're working in time zones, maybe in India or China or Latin America, sometimes all of those in one class, we actually can't be in the office 9 to 5 because a lot of times that class happens at maybe 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So being in the office actually isn't helpful for us. So that's a lot of our education we can do as well is remote. We leverage online technology so that we can help teach students all over the world, not just having them come to Berkeley, which can be very expensive if you're, you know, a corporation wanting to teach 100 people corporate innovation.
Yeah, I see. Okay, so that explains a lot because I was like, how does that work when she's a team leader? Okay, so Elizabeth, yep. One last question here for you. I mean, the Tulsa Remote Program is for a year, and I'm going to just presume you're going to stick it out for that year. But for this program to really make a difference in Tulsa in the long run, ideally, fellows in the program would end up staying. Do you imagine yourself staying beyond a year?
Absolutely. I think just based on what I've seen in 12 hours, I think absolutely. I'm originally from Iowa, so it's kind of nice to get back to a little bit more of the central U.S. Heartland area and get back to my roots a little bit there. But also, I really do enjoy kind of what they're doing to revitalize the area. So I think I see myself here for quite a while.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. But if I may, like the way you described your job, I mean, you described a job that literally can be done from anywhere, right? Anywhere around the world, practically.
Yeah.
So while it would be great for you to end up putting some roots down in Tulsa, I mean, is that realistic? What if you get the travel bug again and want to move to, I don't know, Vermont's got a similar program. You want to try Vermont out?
You know, I have been very fortunate in my life. I was in the Navy, so I got to see the world that way for 5 years. I have been to 44 countries now, lived in Spain, lived in Italy, lived in the UK. All been great, but I really do feel like I'm at a stage where I'm happy to put down roots somewhere, and I think that that could be Tulsa very easily, just based on having been here, and I love the vibe. So I think, I could travel again, but I think I'm ready for some roots.
Well, Elizabeth Saunders, a 2019 Tulsa Remote Fellowship winner. She's also Program Director, Chief of Staff, and Instructor at the Innovation Acceleration Group at the University of California, Berkeley. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Meghna.
All right, let's turn to someone who knows what the germ of this idea for Tulsa Remote is and how it came about. Joining us now from Tulsa as well is Ken Levitt. He's Executive Director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation. The foundation is funding the Tulsa Remote Program. Ken Levitt, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Good to be here.
It's terrific to have you. So give us the sort of the genesis story here around Tulsa Remote. How did this idea come to be that the city said, we want to attract some new people, this is how we're going to do it?
Well, it was pretty organic, really. Our foundation, our main mission really revolves around early opportunity for young children, and early education and maternal child health care, all those kind of issues. But we're a foundation that's based here in Tulsa, and we care a lot about our community, and we have a whole set of initiatives around civic enhancement, whether it's creating new parks or helping to revitalize our downtown or building our music scene. But we often, you know, sit around the coffee table or the water cooler, I guess, and think about, well, what kind of companies could we attract or what kind of industry would come here? And then somebody, a little bit of an out-of-the-box thinker, said, well, you know, what about, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who they're living in San Francisco or Boston or other places that are really expensive, but they could work or live anywhere with their job. And we just started exploring these idea of remote workers. We happened upon the Vermont program and said, well, let's give it a whirl. So it's just so much fun to hear Elizabeth, who's been here all of a day. And I mean, it's just everything I could hope for, the sound of her voice.
So tell me a little bit more about what Tulsa believes it stands to gain by attracting small groups of young professionals.
I think there are a lot of components to that, really. I mean, everybody is involved in trying to create or bring new companies or back offices of different companies. Or, you know, we like everybody else, put in a Amazon HQ2 application. But really, when you come down to it, it's about attracting and retaining highly talented, energetic, creative young people in your community, to add vibrancy to it, to bring new ideas, to get involved. And, you know, maybe being a private philanthropy here, we thought we could give it a whirl to just go person by person, attract 100, 200, 300 people here who could add to that. We've been involved also, by the way, in similar efforts around teachers, Teach for America, or social service volunteers like City Year and artists. So this was a related but novel idea.
So let's just, we have about a minute to go before we have to take a quick break here, Ken. But I do want to ask you quite an important question. I definitely see the utility of trying to draw teachers, policemen, firefighters, you know, those middle-class professionals who the demand for them is already existing, right? Like, they have jobs that need qualified people. But in the Tulsa Remote program, you are drawing people, you're drawing professionals, but they're not necessarily, these are folks who aren't immediately creating jobs. So it's a different kind of development. It's not direct economic development for Tulsa. Is that an issue?
Well, I mean, they're bringing jobs to Tulsa that were not otherwise here in Tulsa. So they're adding, you know, very directly to the economy here. And one fun thing we've also noticed is that most folks are also bringing with them other people, other family members or spouses or children. In fact, this group of 100 folks are actually a group of almost 175 people. So it's definitely incrementally adding to our community.
But if I just may, they're not bringing their jobs. Their jobs have to be somewhere else. What are they bringing? Are they bringing the tax base that they might bring with them as taxpayers for Tulsa?
Yeah, I mean, they're bringing their salary, their paycheck, their family, and their talents.
All right. Well, Ken Levitt, Executive Director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation in Tulsa, Oklahoma, stand by. We are talking about, this is part two of our special series, Where We Call Home, and today we're talking about really innovative programs in cities and some states to draw workers who can work in those cities and states but have their jobs remotely. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's part two of our special series, Where We Call Home. And today we're looking at innovative programs in some cities and states to draw a new generation of workers there. The catch is that you have to be able to work remotely and your job has to be somewhere else. So we want to hear from you. Are you one of the people out there who's able to work remotely? And if so, would you consider moving to a place like Tulsa, Oklahoma, or the state of Vermont if they sweetened the deal a little bit, offered you a stipend or maybe even assistance on a place to live? By the way, want to know what you think, if this is an innovative way for cities and some states to grow their economic base without, say, having to offer major tax incentives for companies. But on the other hand, those companies may bring more jobs than individuals. Now, I should note that we have a survey here, an online survey that we put out to On Point listeners, asking them about remote work, and had about 1,100 responses. Non-scientific survey, I should add. But to the question of, do you work from home? 45.9%, so 46% of folks said no, they don't work from home. 25% roughly say they can occasionally work from home. Just 14% said they can telecommute. So maybe there aren't as many people out there who are able to participate in programs like this. What do we need to change that? We're joined today by Ken Levitt. He's executive director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation. He's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And joining us now from Colchester, Vermont, is Senator Michael Sorotkin. He's Vermont State Senator and chair of the Committee on Economic Development, Housing, and General Affairs. And he championed the Vermont Remote Worker Grant Program. Senator Sorotkin, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, I mean, you heard, we talked with Ken a little bit about the Tulsa program. How similar is it to what Vermont has launched a while back?
Actually, it's quite similar. I'd say the benefits are slightly different. The amount of the benefit to the remote worker is comparable. We started out with this idea from a basic premise. How can we piggyback on Vermont's strengths to improve our economy here in Vermont? I'm a newly minted chair of the Economic Development Committee in the Senate, and the very first witness I had was the Secretary of the Commerce Department of the state of Vermont, and I asked him almost the very first question, what makes Vermont unique? And he said, quality of life is what makes Vermont unique, and the fact that we're in close proximity to Boston and New York. At the same time, we were learning about the change in the economy in terms of people working more and more remotely. You put the three together and we came up with this plan. I think it's proven to be a win-win situation.
Right. So roughly a similar $10,000 grant or assistance for people who participate in the program, right?
We don't give cash.
Okay.
We reimburse people's moving expenses, pay for their broadband, for co-working space and computer hardware and software.
Okay. But Senator, if I may, I mean, you're talking about all the things Vermont has to offer, quality of life, culture, very strong local communities as well. But on the other hand, I mean, this program was launched because Vermont needs new workers, right? I mean, it's a rapidly aging state. So all of those positives about what Vermont already has hasn't been enough to attract more businesses and more workers thus far. Is that the basic challenge?
It is. And I think people's image of Vermont is maple syrup, cows, Ben and Jerry's, tourism, skiing. But they're not, it's a great place to visit. And we have like 13 million people come every year to the state of Vermont to visit. But I don't think they think of it enough as a place to live and work. They don't understand we have low crime, we have clean air, we have great higher education. And one of the most important things, I think, for certain individuals, there's the possibility to come to our state, and because you're sort of a big fish in a little sea, you have an opportunity to get involved in your community and make a difference. And I think a lot of people are attracted to that.
Mm. Ken Levitt, just want to have you jump back in here. I mean, what do you think about the particular challenges that Vermont has? Is that sort of what was driving the Tulsa Remote Program, or was it something different?
No, it's very similar. I think kind of analogous to what we're hearing about Vermont. People have a certain frame of reference or set of expectations about Tulsa, but when folks get here, they tend to really fall in love with the place. And really, just very well put, is the idea that it's big enough that we have got a lot to offer, a lot of things to do, but small enough that folks who want to make an impact in their community, they're interested in dealing with issues of homelessness, or they're interested in dealing with addressing social justice problems like incarceration or investing in the arts. You can make an impact here like immediately. And that's very attractive. And we really saw that come through with the applicants for the program. People wanted to be in a place where they could have the kind of impact in a community that felt comfortable and manageable like Tulsa. So that was a big drawing point for the program.
Hmm. Senator Sorotkin, I just want to ask you something in particular about a challenge that Vermont has. And actually, we've got a comment that's come in to us via Facebook about this exact issue from Becky Castle. She's a Vermonter. She says, I think the program is a total bust. Vermont has very high taxes and a high cost of living, so $10,000 will help pay for the additional taxes for 1 or maybe 2 years. But if Vermont wants a sustainable economy, it needs to be more business-friendly with a lot less regulation. And broadband internet is only reliably available in the Burlington area and near Middlebury. So if you need to be able to work remotely, are there only a couple of places that people ought to be able would be able to live in Vermont to participate in this program?
I don't think that's fully accurate. We, like any other rural state, have broadband problems trying to serve the last mile of a dirt road, let's say. But otherwise, there are many communities within the state of Vermont that have strong broadband access. And part of our program, and where we're putting a bunch of our efforts here this year, is to develop co-working spaces where people can go work together in a town center. We're very much into smart growth in the state of Vermont. So I don't think broadband, while we do have a problem with the last mile and people's residences, there are plenty of places where people could work in rural Vermont and outside Chittenden County and outside Burlington.
Okay, well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Mia, who's calling from Brattleboro, Vermont. Mia, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Leah Goodman.
Oh, okay, Leah, go ahead. I'm sorry about that.
Not at all. So I am somebody who telecommutes from Vermont. I moved here in 2013 with a job at Newsweek magazine, a full-time job, and I came from New York. I love Vermont, and the quality of life is wonderful. But I think that something the state really needs to take into account is when you move from a place like New York to Vermont, you go from a very turnkey lifestyle where you have one bill for heat and electric and, you know, a lot of your broadband's all bundled together. Things are really turnkey. You come out here, you have about three times as many bills and you have to be ready for it. I own a house out here and I have an office downtown and I have to streamline constantly because there's a water bill, a trash bill. You know, transportation issues are really major out here. And you have many, many high property taxes and additional taxes that you just don't deal with in the city. So telecommuters really need to be ready.
Yeah. Well, Leah, thank you for your call. Senator Sorotkin, you want to respond to her?
Well, as I'm sure Ken would say, when we approach economic development on a state level, we try to be creative in this idea and address almost on an individual basis. This is not a big program to start out with, though it is growing. The governor has quadrupled down on this program after 1 year because it's been so successful. But we have a lot of money into workforce development, into the more traditional economic development tool of helping corporations create jobs. But we need to, in addition to the old way of continuing to put money into corporations to bring jobs here, we also need to attract workers here as well. And Vermont simply can't compete with the bigger states like New York. We can't do the Amazon HQ2 bids. We can't put the $3 billion down that New York City tried to do. So we have to find creative ways to address our demographics. And Vermont is not an expensive place to live when you compare it to the areas we're likely to draw from, like New York and Boston.
Right. So everything's relative there on that front.
Exactly.
Well, Senator Michael Sorotkin and Ken Levitt, hang on here for just a minute, because I want to bring in Marianne Wanamaker. She's joining us from Knoxville, Tennessee. She's Associate Professor of Economics at the Haslam College of Business at the University of Tennessee. She's also a workforce policy advisor to the Trump administration and was the chief domestic economist for the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Served on that in that post from July 2017 to July 2018. Professor Wanamaker, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
So it's great to have you. I hear that you're a fan of this idea of drawing remote workers to cities and states who need a new influx of people. Why is that?
Well, I think we've seen the rise in job recruitment efforts in other places, such as the Amazon HQ2 effort that has been mentioned many times on the program already. We've seen that rise, and those programs tend to be pretty anti-competitive. In other words, the bigger you are, the more money states throw at you to move. And as an economist, you don't want to see an unlevel playing field. And these sorts of programs are much more level. The competitive nature, in particular, of the Tulsa program really incentivizes people to put in a good application for Tulsa to draw the workers they need without representing this unlevel playing field.
So can you tell me a little bit more about why you think it levels the playing field a bit more? Because I'm never going to underestimate the importance of, you know, human capital, right, and drawing talented entrepreneurial people to any community. But I'm just wondering, I mean, by how much does that level the playing field if we are comparing that to, you know, drawing a company that might bring 200, 500, 1,000 jobs instead?
Right. Well, again, the way you describe that, those incentives to bring the bigger companies in, the bigger the company, the more incentives they can extract from local communities, and that puts small companies at a big disadvantage. Mm-hmm. So as economists, we're much more comfortable with programs that don't subsidize bigger companies at higher rates.
So there, that would produce the longer-term benefit for these smaller cities and states.
Yeah, I mean, from the perspective of Vermont in particular, so Senator Schrotkin just said this, that they're not going to be competitive for the big kind of Amazon HQ2. They can be quite competitive in recruiting remote workers who are interested in the quality of life that's already been raised on the program, and can contribute back to the community through their tax expenditures. Mm.
Ken Levitt, let me just bring you back in here into the conversation. Do you see this as a leveling of the playing field between, you know, bigger states and cities and places like Tulsa?
I think there is that. I mean, there have been a few things that I've been surprised on the upside, even in just this very early stage of the program. One is the number of additional people that winners are bringing with them. So I mentioned family members. This young lady named Lili, who is a Stanford graduate, and she's working with the Harlem Globetrotters, and she travels around the country. She's won one of the remote scholarships, and both of her parents have moved here with her. And one of them is a remote worker, and one works for the Corps of Engineers. But the other thing that I've noticed, and it kind of gets to your earlier question to me, which was a good challenge about are you really adding jobs or just bringing another job, I've noted in many of my early conversations with folks who are moving here the desire to hire more people in Tulsa as part of the beachhead that these companies are putting in Tulsa. So let's say somebody needs to hire a digital specialist or an analyst, or somebody said they put Tulsa into a competition with their company with three other communities, one in another country, to bring 300 jobs here to Tulsa. So I think there's a multiplier effect in addition just to the dollars circulating around the economy. But we're going to see through word of mouth and through family members and other hiring an extra impact that we had never expected. So that's going to be fun to watch and assess.
Yeah, interesting. So let's go back to the phones. Let's go to John, who's calling from Williston, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just kind of reiterating what the earlier caller from Burlington had mentioned. Williston is like a suburb of Burlington for the most part. And I work throughout the entire state. My job takes me all over the state of Vermont. And what I see and what I hear, and there was actually a program on public radio yesterday talking about broadband services throughout rural New England, and rural Vermont is very much lacking in broadband access. So that would make it difficult for someone who wanted to live here and have the pastoral lifestyle of, you know, rural Vermont with cows in your backyard, because you're not going to have the broadband services necessarily. And the other part of it is it's very expensive to live in Vermont. I moved here 14 years ago from Connecticut, thinking that I was going to be able to, you know, end up moving into a pretty nice place for not a whole lot of money. And it turns out that the opposite is true, especially in Burlington area. The rents are very high. And it's just not what I expected, but I love it, and I do not ever plan to move.
Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Senator Schrotkin, let me turn back to you. Just want to hear your response to John, because he's obviously maybe a loyal critic of the state there.
Fair enough. One thing I can say, in my committee, we are working on both the housing and the broadband issues to improve the situation. We're aware of the fact that we can do better. Nevertheless, as I said before, we have state-of-the-art in Chittenden County. We have in Springfield, Vermont, on the other side of the state, broadband. And the bigger problems are getting to the last mile, and we have emphasis on the co-working space. I did want to mention echo the surprise that Ken sees. We've had several people in our program, as a result of just learning of the program, wind up moving their businesses from Colorado and from Quebec, adding multiple employees to the system just because of the amazing amount of publicity that this program has generated. We actually have put a value on it, about $5 million in earned media as a result of launching this program, which was nothing more than a word of mouth program. And I'm told that we've gotten over 2 billion with a B impressions or hits on about our remote work program. So Vermont's out there. We're open for business. We're open for people to come here and move.
Well, Senator Michael Srotkin, joining us from Colchester, Vermont, state senator and chair of the Committee on Economic Development, Housing, and General Affairs, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Ken Levitt and Marianne Wanamaker, stand by for just a moment. We've got to take a quick break. We're talking about programs in some states and towns about drawing remote workers there. They can't, you know, live here but work someplace else. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, it's part two of our special series, Where We Call Home, and we're taking a look at innovative programs from some cities and some states, drawing young entrepreneurial professionals, saying, hey, come live here. We'll give you a stipend. We'll help you find a place to stay, give you a co-working space even. The catch is that you have to be able to work remotely, so your job must be elsewhere, and we want to know what you think about that idea. And by the way, a little earlier, we put out a survey to On Point listeners, non-scientific survey, but we got about 1,100 responses. And one of the questions in that survey was, where do you live or why do you live where you do? Job location was the number one response. 42.5% of the respondents said they live where they do because of where their jobs are. Well, we're joined today by Ken Levitt. He's executive director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation. He's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa has a program called Tulsa Remote that's trying to draw these young professionals. Marianne Wanamaker also joins us. She's with us from Knoxville, Tennessee. She's associate professor of economics at the Haslam College of Business at the University of Tennessee. And Professor Wanamaker, I wanted to just turn a question or a comment that we received online to you. Someone calling them Matthew Perrant says, maybe we should put the incentives into local businesses that offer jobs to young workers or help locals find affordable housing in the middle of this second home market. What do you think about that idea about investing in local businesses versus drawing people from out of city or state?
Well, I think, you know, states and local governments invest in businesses in many ways. I mean, they're providing infrastructure, they're providing schooling, education systems. Just kind of your standard practice of state and local governments is to support local businesses. So I think this is a question about recruitment, not about supporting what you already have.
So let's go to the phone. Let's go to Sam, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? About 10 years ago, maybe more than that, my corporate job I had outside of Philadelphia said, hey, I could move someplace anywhere in the United States to live. So I picked Maine, which was great. And I was getting paid Philadelphia pay living in the Maine, which was the cost of living was a lot lower. And everything was great for years and years. And then one day I got laid off. And then what happened was that money that was making from Philadelphia pay was making six-figure salary. Well, they're going to have that after the fact. I got laid off, and it was hard to replace. I had to end up literally commuting to New Hampshire, Massachusetts, to replace that money.
Because you couldn't find a similar job in Maine.
Exactly.
Okay, so I'm wondering, Sam, then what's the lesson that your example is giving to the rest of us? Do these programs?
Well, what I did, I was a network engineer, to tell you the truth, and when I noticed there was no one providing the services I was providing up here, so I started my own business and started doing that now. And I've been doing that for almost 7 years.
Ah, interesting.
So
okay.
It kind of worked out there.
All right. Well, Sam, thank you so much for your call. Marianne Wanamaker, what do you think about Sam's story there? Is that part of even if it takes longer and through some ups and downs, the Sam experience, the sort of multiplier effect that we've been discussing as well?
Yeah, so if you lose your job and you find yourself in rural Vermont, what do you do?
Yeah,
it's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about it before. I mean, one thing I think is important about that is that the U.S. is increasingly seeing employers using non-compete agreements. And under a non-compete agreement, Sam wouldn't have been allowed to begin his own consulting company. And so that's an interesting intersection with what's going on here is, you know, you get laid off, you're stuck in a rural location without a whole lot of job opportunities. And then you've got this additional weight that says you can't start up your own company.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in general, that is a problem. You know, you find yourself in a place like Vermont, lose your job, and then
right.
What do you do?
But then he saw a gap in the market, though, and was able to launch his own business
there. Yeah, no, I think it's great. You know, the U.S. is really in a kind of an entrepreneurship crisis, which I think maybe people don't fully recognize that. But we really have incredibly low startup rates. They've been declining for almost 30 years. And so so we'd love to see policies that even if inadvertently led to greater entrepreneurship.
Well, let's go to Steve, who's calling from Miami, Oklahoma. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. So we've talked about that a lot of communities and states throw a lot of money at industry to attract new jobs. But I think what's happening in Tulsa and some other places is the whole concept of economic gardening. They're trying to plant people, smart people with good ideas in their communities and then build what you might refer to as an ecosystem to support those entrepreneurs who will attract friends and family and capital and maybe start new businesses and who knows. Someday, through the generous philanthropy in Tulsa, we may have the next, you know, tech pioneer,
mm-hmm.
or the next business might be created that is a game changer not only for Oklahoma's economy but for conceivably the world. But my question is, with the generous philanthropy that started this in Tulsa, and the fellow from Vermont it comes from a state perspective, but is Oklahoma seeing a shift toward making these public investments into these kinds of programs, and how can government partner with the private philanthropy to do these things and make them work?
Right.
And is there a model of that exists?
Okay.
So I'm going to hang up and listen.
Steve, terrific question, though. Thank you so much for your call. So, Ken Levitt, that one's for you. First of all, I love Steve's phrase of economic gardening. But as Steve rightly pointed out, the Kaiser Family Foundation provided the initial money for Tulsa Remote. Is there interest from city government, state government, and also to spread it across other places in Oklahoma?
It's a great question from Miami, Oklahoma. And if you're from Oklahoma, you know it's Miami, not Miami.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, I'm kidding. And that was a great point. And what's nice about the role that philanthropy can play is it can really kind of create a bit of an experiment and see how it works. And this is very much being watched by our state policymakers. In fact, our Secretary of Commerce and Lieutenant Governor were with us in a meeting last week where we were briefing them about the progress of this program. And there was enormous excitement about it. And we actually have a very generous statewide quality jobs credit that pays back in a tax incentive 5% of payroll costs for a new job for qualifying businesses. And we pointed out that a lot of that credit often goes to companies that would otherwise be expanding anyway, even if they didn't get the subsidy. And what we liked about this program is we could monitor it and see whether we're truly getting incremental new people. And if they stayed for a number of years, maybe the program could be reimbursed by state government to go out and grow and expand the effort. So there's a great conversation going, private and public sector, about how this could potentially be collaborated on and maybe grown over time. But let us take the risk first to see if it works. And then if it does, and if there's a compelling public argument for it, then that's a conversation that can happen, you know, say a year from now.
Marianne Wanamaker, what do you say to that?
I think that's a great idea. These people like this, people with stable jobs, with, you know, steady incomes, they pay for themselves. And so there's plenty of reason to think that the public would be interested in subsidizing these sort of things.
Yeah. You know, I've got you're speaking of taxation. There's some interesting questions here coming in about the question about individual taxation. For example, a listener named Toyota says, I think this is the start of a good idea, but this version of it, I can't see working for a couple of reasons. One of them being taxation. I'd have to pay taxes in two states, depending. Is that a concern, Marianne?
Usually, it depends. I mean, you know, the ins and outs of the tax code, it depends. Yeah. But generally, you know, where you are working is where you pay taxes. Now, I think it's correct that you have to worry about this, particularly for Vermont. This is a challenge because Vermont has some pretty high income taxes. And the entire eastern border of Vermont abuts a state with very limited income tax. And so you would have to worry about that dynamic.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Dale, who's calling from Tampa Bay, Florida. Dale, you're on the air.
Hi there. I was just listening. I kind of came in the middle of everything, but just in regard to being able to work remotely, it just totally lowers the stress of traffic and everything and improves your quality of life. And I certainly would not be opposed to moving from Florida, which for most people is idyllic, to an area like, you know, rural Vermont, just to get away from the craziness of it all, because this state has been marketed to the point where there's overcrowding. So to be able to work from home, to work remotely in a Vermont environment would be stupendous, and I could work from home and, you know, spend time with my dog.
Yeah. Well, Dale, thank you so much for your call. Got lots of comments about this coming in. Someone who says, calling themselves NPR junkie, says, I currently telecommute as well as my husband. The company he works for would allow him to work from anywhere. But NPR junkie says they work for the state of Michigan, and I can only work within the state. Would love to be able to move to another state and still have my job, but unfortunately I can't. Also, these areas want younger workers. We're in our late 40s and nobody wants us. Ken Levitt, is that an issue that maybe you're looking for a very small niche of people?
I wouldn't want to admit that it's only for young folks. In fact, our application pool was very, very diverse in a lot of ways, and the folks we picked were across a wide spectrum. And yes, even among age. Although I will tell you, there is definitely a heightened level of interest in not the folks fresh out of college or maybe 3 or 4 years into their career, but those who are maybe about to embark upon call it family formation. A lot of folks who are engaged or they've had a significant other for a long period of time, and they feel like that where they currently are is so expensive and so burdensome that it's just not sustainable to carve out a life plan. And so we saw a lot of people kind of at the precipice of those big life decisions, kid decisions, who had a strong interest to at least the Tulsa proposition.
Let's get another call here. Let's go to Art, who's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Art, you're on the air.
Hi. My question, my initial reaction was, gee, it's a great idea to telecommute. But Oklahoma has a very right-leaning red reputation. What are you doing to try to balance the political outlook of the state to attract people from some of the areas you're trying to attract them, like San Francisco and New York? Then when I heard the Vermont person, maybe you've got just the reverse problem. But how are you dealing with getting your state to have a balanced political reputation?
Well, Art, thank you for your call. Ken Levitt, I'm going to turn back to you there. I'm going to presume that the Kaiser Family Foundation isn't trying to change the political makeup of Oklahoma, because that's an entirely separate issue or question. But let me ask you, though, there's quite a long questionnaire that applicants to the program had to fill out. So what kind of person were you looking for?
Well, I think we wanted to find people who would be very invested in the community, who were looking to attach themselves in a very deep way and make a difference. But I will say, to the caller's point, probably the most consistent concern that was raised was kind of along the, that point. You know, my aunt is really worried about whether I, as a such and such person, will be welcomed in a state that's known to be very conservative. And we were, it was great to get that kind of comment because we could discuss it and back and forth. And there were long chains of discussion on email and on chat communities about that. You know, Tulsa is actually a pretty purple place, and it's very open towards, you know, we're trying to change things in many ways. We've got some big problems in our community, whether it's a high rate of incarceration or childhood poverty or teen pregnancy. And I think it was also exciting for people to be a part of change making. And we invited people to share those kind of concerns. And actually, during one of our meet and greets in Tulsa, there was a young woman who she said her aunt was terrified for her to be in Tulsa because she thought it was too conservative. And in walked a very dynamic Democrat state legislator into the bar. And I said, huh, meet my friend Monroe. He'll tell you about some opportunities you can have to make a difference. So we're going to welcome all comers. And I think that's the kind of concern that is part of the mix.
Honestly, I think more political mixing in this country can only be a good thing. Maybe I'm being too naive about that, but being in our little sort of red and blue silos, it hasn't really done us much good yet so far. Marianne Wanamaker, we've just got about 2 minutes here left to go. I'm wondering, if these types of programs are ones you would advocate that other communities take up, and if so, should they follow the model set out by Tulsa and Vermont?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, there aren't that many teleworkers in the U.S. And so while I think this is a great, you know, kind of a niche strategy for Tulsa and Vermont, I'm not sure I can promote large-scale adoptions. I think in general, when communities have to think hard about how they're going to put their best face forward, like Ken has just articulated, how they're going to recruit businesses and job creators, what kind of place they're going to be, what their comparative advantage is, I think all of those conversations are really healthy and really good for the local community, even if they don't succeed. And then if they do succeed in recruiting, in recruiting new businesses, recruiting new residents, then that's kind of a double victory. So, yeah, I think just the process is important. And then, again, if you're able to recruit the business or the person, then kudos to you.
Well, Marianne Wanamaker, Associate Professor of Economics at the Haslam College of Business at the University of Tennessee, joining us from Knoxville, Tennessee today. Professor Wanamaker, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ken Levitt, Executive Director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation, which is funding the Tulsa Remote Program, with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma today. Ken Levitt, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
So, folks, this was part two of our special series, Where We Call Home. Next Monday, we're going to have part three, and we'll ask the question about home ownership and whether or not it's still core to realizing the American dream. We're going to take a look at the pros and cons of renting versus buying in the United States today. It's part three of Where We Call Home, and it's next Monday. And we want you to keep taking part in our series surveys that we're putting out. Go to onpointradio.org to take the survey and to share your thoughts about where you call home. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoisch, Asil Kibbe, David Marino, and Alex Pena. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.